Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Hi, my name is Ann McMillan. I'm the master builder, helping to build stronger and better lives and businesses. And we want to welcome you, Iona McMillan, myself, to another episode of Hashtag My Investing Story. As volunteers with Better Investing, we are very excited every single Wednesday to bring to you another special guest. But let's talk a little bit about the organization, and then we'll introduce our phenomenal guest to you tonight. Better Investing is a not-for-profit 501c3 organization, which has helped over 5 million, I love saying that number, 5 million individual investors to learn how to become lifelong investors. We do this by improving all of our financial future. We provide as volunteers unbiased investment education and powerful online stock analysis tools to create a wonderful financial success in our lives and also in our businesses if we are so inclined. But Iona McMillan and I tonight just want to introduce you to our special guest. And our special guest sharing his hashtag My Investing Story is none other than Jamie the Elder. And Jamie the Elder is an Army veteran and a lifelong entrepreneur who was born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I know Bob, when, if he's not on already, he's on his way. He started his first business when he was only 21 years old and actually started a business with 1-800-GOT-JUNK. This was a franchise in the state of Wisconsin. And so I'm not going to go through all of his bio because I think it's very important that you hear from him. So with that thought in mind, let me introduce my co-host, Iona McNeil. How are you this evening, Iona?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
Awesome.
Good. So I'm excited to have Jamie Elder on. We just met maybe a month ago, not even 2 months ago, for the Climb Summer Stock Market Experience. You were one of the Tuesday Speaker Series guests on the evening. We had an entrepreneur panel. So hearing a little bit about your story, I wanted to invite you on Hashtag My Investing Story podcast because you have a very unique journey to how you got here where you are right now. And so we're going to start you at the beginning in Milwaukee, a young black boy growing up in Milwaukee. Talk to us about growing up in Milwaukee and how money was talked about or not talked about in your household and what you got exposed to during that time.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for this opportunity to be back here. And it was an exciting opportunity to Bob, and then also an exciting opportunity to be here with your audience and talking about something that's very important to our, not just country, but to our community specifically. And going back to what you're saying, as I think I shared previously, that, you know, when you're a young person of color in Wisconsin, you grow up with the low expectations from the rest of the state, and then you grow up with low expectations of yourself because you have this aspiration gap because you really don't see people of color who are in positions of leadership and power the way they are now. You didn't see us as CEOs and investors and bankers, even small business owners, right? And so, you know, my relationship with money growing up, my father was in, you know, worked 40 years at A.O. Smith as a manufacturer, and my mother was a teacher's aide. And my father pretty much knew, he had a Depression era mindset, so he was born in 1921, so he'd be 100 years old if he was alive today. And so he was always about saving. So every single program that the bank offers, he probably invested in it. There was, you know, checking account, savings account, stuff like that. But, you know, and many of your audience know that a lot of what the bank offers is just like low interest rate type of, you know, savings, bonds, stuff of that nature. But that's what I did learn. It was always like work hard, save your money, work hard, save your money. But we didn't you really have a conversation beyond that. We didn't talk about the stock market. Like, I would listen to the news, I hear about Dow Jones, I thought that was a guy. I didn't know it was an actual market index. And then other than that, though, I was involved, like a lot of kids in Northside of Milwaukee, got involved in things I shouldn't have been involved in because that was the nature of my community. So you getting so as, one of my people inspired me, Bishop Omar Jawar always said, it's like, Jamie, you had the right process, but you had the wrong product when you were growing up. And so I was always entrepreneurial. So I went to Rufus King High School. It was a school for the college bound. I was more interested in entrepreneurship than academics, but there was no junior achievement in my school. There was nobody telling me how to convert, what I was doing with, selling T-shirts and stuff and selling other items and stuff to my classmates and stuff on the street. Nobody was teaching me how to actually monetize that the right way and the process and how to get legally established and become a small business owner. And I kind of missed that dot-com craze because I graduated in 2000, and it was like a little later that Mark Zuckerberg and stuff came around and said, hey, 18 years old, you too can form a business. And so that was kind of like our psychology and around money. It was really about the more you make, the more you have, the more you can spend.
So when did that start to change for you? Because you just took us, from childhood into high school. How did it start to change, and what was even your thought process of going into the military?
And so for me, it was basically a situation to where we had a strong 18 and out rule by my parents. So it's probably today it's kind of people like, but growing up, it's like I knew at 4 years old I had to leave by 18, otherwise you're not considered a man. My sister's left, and I see like my brother-in-law Anthony Davis. he just had a child with my middle sister Sarah Charmaine. That was just her mindset attitude. You better be independent by 18. And so by the time I was in high school, I had like a 2.3 GPA, and my father pretty much sat me down and said, he had cancer at the time too. He's like, you got one of four options: either go to college, get a career, go to the military, or go to jail. But pick one because you got to get out of this house. And I knew I didn't have the grades for college. I didn't want to work at McDonald's for the rest of my life. And I definitely, I was a playboy thug. I wasn't trying to get in real trouble. You be around real people. And so I really was saying, like, nah, I'm not going to jail. I'm not doing any violent crimes. I'm not going to stay up this life. So that's why I ended up, taking the military as an option. And so when I was in the Army, though, I was a computer geek, information systems operator analyst. Because, it's year 2000. I thought, computers are the future. That was going to change the world. I thought I was going to come out and make so much money on Microsoft or IBM or something. But when I started doing a job, I didn't have a passion for it at all. Because technology moved so fast. So by the time I got out of basic training, there were colonels and other officers saying, hey, fix my BlackBerry. I didn't know what a BlackBerry was. When I went into the Army, it was like flip phones. Now you got this little computer thing. I'm supposed to fix this. And so at that, I really had to start challenging myself about what I wanted to do. So I kind of self-taught. I watched movies like Wall Street before in the past. And, I watched other movies around that time that talk about stock market investing. They made it seem really sexy. Like you take a bunch of money, put it into the market, you get a Ferrari in a year. So like, okay, let me try that. It was like another movie called Boiler Room that really inspired me too with Mia Long in it. So I said, okay, that's going to be my lifestyle. I'm about to go out there and start buying stocks and become like this, this ruthless stockbroker. And then so I'm taking my money from the Army, which is like maybe 18 grand a year. And I'm putting a lot of that back into the market. So I taught myself the stock market. So I started buying a lot of Disney stock, USANA stock, JLL, Johnson & Johnson. And as you know, it's like you buy stocks at $500 at a time. It's just like one day it goes up, one day it goes down. One day it goes up, one day it goes down. Then you start reading, compound interest, that's how it works. It takes time, it takes compound interest. I'm like, yeah, I'm not getting my Ferrari for like 20 years, so I need to do something else. So I was like, okay, I'm impatient. So I kept playing in the stock market. At the time, I didn't realize, I should have been putting my money in on the dips. I didn't see 9/11 happening. I didn't see 2006 happening where I could have took my inheritance, put it at the bottom, and then rolled it up. That's how I would have got my Ferrari. But I was at the top. So When I started reading many magazines, one magazine I read, I can't remember which magazine it was, but they had this little snippet that said 80% of wealthy people, multimillionaires in the United States, attributed their wealth to either business investment or business ownership. And I said, I need to own a business. And so I started doing like network marketing companies. Then my father passed away. I took my inheritance, and it took like maybe 2 years. But around 2004, that's when I bought my first company, 1-800 Got a Junk franchise. And so I said I was going to create wealth by not just being a shareholder of a larger company. I wanted to own the whole company.
Well, I did have two things. The first one, I think, kind of slipped me. But if you don't mind, I would like to speak a little bit to what you learned during the passing of your father, because I think there are a lot of money lessons that a family learns. You never want the day to come, but you quickly find out how organized the person was, how unorganized they were, what they planned for, what they didn't plan for. So can you talk to us a little bit about did he have a will? Did he have a trust in place? Why possibly did it take you 2 years to get this quote-unquote inheritance? Could you walk us a little bit through that?
Yeah. So I had a unique upbringing. So my father, I could tell you the day my childhood ended. It was that Friday when you come home for spring break. Like, you should be, most people amped up. Like, okay, I got 1 week off. I'm about to go crazy and then come back and do my finals, and then the summer's going to come. And that ninth grade, so it was like 1997, I came home that Friday, and my father said, we need to talk. So I was kind of a troublesome kid. I thought I did something wrong. He's going to talk to me about it. And he sat me down in the living room, and he never sat me down like that before, and he told me he had prostate cancer. And that, kind of let me know that this was going to be the beginning of, like, the end for him. And so I could say like that, my childhood ended that day, because my father is a very intentional man. So every time he would pay taxes, I would go with him to H&R Block and listen to how he talked with tax advisors. Every time he went to the bank and made deposits and transferred money from checking to savings and to other financial vehicles, I was there listening. I didn't understand what they were talking about, but I was there listening. Even when he paid property taxes, he would take me downtown to City Hall and observe him going through that process, because, like, you will have to do all these things probably sooner than later, probably sooner than many of your friends. And so I was prepared in that way to handle adult responsibilities, especially money management. And so when he passed, he did have a will. So there was a succession plan in place. It wasn't a battle, so that got ugly, right? We never had, like, siblings suing each other. It was nothing like that. It was just, loose items, like, who car is that? Who clothes is that? It was just stuff like that. But other than that, it was a quick transfer. So for me, it was like, I'm 19 years old, and I got, like, a six-figure inheritance. What do I got to do with it? That was the fear I had. So I would tell people, having gone through that, because I had a lot of cash burn in my life, especially through my 20s, I would say, having too much money at too soon is probably as bad as having too little money at any point in time in your life.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm glad you actually walked us through what your father did to prepare you, because last week, our guest, Travis, we talked about how children learn through osmosis, but in this current generation, many parents are doing for children and not allowing them to see what they are doing. They're not allowing them to, we don't write checks anymore. So kids are not seeing us pay bills in that same kind of way. I'm so glad that you shared that because many people, I'm sure, parents and grandparents ask, oh, well, how do I get my child to not only know how to spend money? It's like, well, you have to show them what else you do with money, because if you're only taking them to the store to shop with you, but they never see you pay bills or they never see you pay taxes, unfortunately, that's the only exposure to money or the use, that use of money that they see. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, again, you having this inheritance and where your mindset was at that time, because you got the inheritance before you saw the article and wanted to open up this business. So, you know, if you can remember your kind of young and free, or if you want to call it unplanned and uneducated time period, you know, can you speak a little bit to that and how those experiences helped you wise up to do something different, you know? And did you even blow through all the money, or did you stop, you know, midway through? Like, when was that wake-up call for you?
Yeah, that's funny. It's like, I mean, one of the things is that, again, we, you know, me and my sister had it, we grew up in a different, way different than many of our friends and family. And so I was taught very young is that to adopt the old man's mindset. So my father would say, you know, a young man cares about how much money he makes. An old man cares about how much money he keeps. So keep an old man mindset. So even when I got all that money, you know, my friend would be the first people to tell you, like, our lifestyle didn't change. We were eating at McDonald's. We just had McDonald's plus cheese. That was it. We didn't go, we weren't going to Red Lobster because I feel like that's rich people stuff. And so the most luxury item I probably bought was like a Lincoln LS, like I paid cash for that, was like $18,000. But other than that, you know, because, you know, I'm a young man. I got to have a status symbol. Lady, I didn't own anything. Ladies like guys or cars back then still do sometimes. So that was my thing. But other than that, I was like, I'm going to reinvest all this in business. And so I took, you know, it cost a significant amount of money. Probably like over half of that went into 100 got junk because, I mean, franchises cost a lot. You got to buy a truck. Like those, it's probably gone up in price. But back then, just to buy that blue, not even the truck, just that blue box by itself is $10,000. So that gives you an idea of the capital requirements it takes to like start a company. And for me, I looked at it and my mindset was this, is that I want to start a business. I have no business school education. I don't know. I don't have any mentoring. I don't have no business network. I'm completely coming brand new. It was to the point that after the fact that one of the vice presidents at the time of 1-800-GOT-JUNK, Cameron Harrell, and I don't blame him for this. Some people were like, he shouldn't have said that. That's probably racist or whatever. He sat me down after the fact, after he approved me for the franchise. And he said, when you applied, I thought this was a joke. Why would, you know, some kid with no business school education, no business experience, think they could run their own franchise? So I only allowed you to come up here so I could teach you a lesson. And I was shocked in your interview how much you impressed me. And so I was like, so that's how serious and committed I was. And so I looked at it, I said, best case scenario out of this whole experience, you know, I become rich and finally get my Ferrari. Worst case scenario, I just paid the equivalent of a business school education on Marquette. Either way, I come out ahead. And so, yeah, I kind of came out in between. Like, you know, got junk. I did it for 2 years. I kind of doubled my investment. But because the franchises was growing really rapidly, I was boxing against the lake, I had to sell out. And so I sold the company. I got a profit. And I also got the education. And I flipped that into going to my own company, which was Landlord Concierge, which was my first startup. And that was doing real estate services. And that one was more of a cash burn because we back then, 2006, we didn't have stuff like the business model canvas and the lean launchpad and the startup this and the startup that. It was still like the SBA thing of like, do a business plan and then go get the loan.
Yeah. Very archaic.
Yeah, very archaic. No, there was no Facebook, no Twitter. Harvard didn't put up half of their curriculum online. And so it was like, I can't even imagine how people started businesses back then. Like, so even like Ms. McNeil, I'm just like, I'm shocked. Like, you started a business before like 2010. And so, you know,
a lot of cash was burnt.
Exactly. And so we were searching for our business model for the first couple of years. And I don't know if she's on here or not, Zelda was actually one of my clients. By the time we realized we should be doing association management, which is basically we should just be managing condos and not just giving a la carte services to like small to medium-sized landlords who really couldn't afford us. By the time you figured that out, it was 2008 and the whole everything collapsed. And so, yeah, I kind of hit rock bottom.
Wow. Wow. That 4 year, I mean, that 4 year experience was like tight. Two businesses, two kind of spectrum of experiences. Where were you, not just mentally, but what was that point for you after you got out of the real estate concierge services business? What did you think was next for you? And what was that next move? Because you had, I mean, you know, coming out of 1-800-JUNK, you can kind of be like, oh, I did that. You know, like 2 years, you know, got a profit, sold the business. But once you have that other experience as an entrepreneur, it can kind of humble you and ground you. Sometimes that sends a person to go work a job.
Yeah.
So what did you end up choosing to do?
The latter. So career-wise, I always say 06 to 09 was like, I call it the dark wilderness. It was so traumatic for me. Because I started out with 1-800-GOT-JUNK. I was literally on the front page of the Journal of Sentinel business section my first week in business. So I'm thinking, I'm 21, I'm feeling myself. So by the time 08 hit and I had everything that had collapsed, it was like, you know, I tell people, I was like, I was Icarus. I moved too close to the sun and I burned my wings. I was taking an hourly job. This is the first time I ever shared this publicly. I had to take I was still doing money, landlord concierge, but just to like pay my bills, I was working nights as a janitor to clean power. That's how much all my cash is going back to the business. And so it was very humbling. Like during the day, I'm a business owner. At night, there's people at call centers who won't recognize my existence. It wasn't until 2009 where, you know, my mentor, you know, Robert Burr, I say, you know, he kind of took that father figure role onto me. And he worked in the Milwaukee Chamber of Commerce. He's the person who always told me, like, Jamie, this is how you come into this environment with government and business without losing your sense of self. Because a lot of people feel like, I can do business, but I don't want to sell out. Well, you don't have to sell out. Like, you can go inside and transform the inside out. And so I never lost my sense of self, my sense of character, my sense of humor, nothing, going in these environments, whether I was the youngest, the darkest, the least educated, the poorest. Like, I've been all four of those things at one time in environments I've been in. But the people will just simply leave and say, I really like you. I want to give you opportunity. And so that's what happened in 2009. Corey Jo Biddle, she still runs Fuel Milwaukee. She says, I heard you do entrepreneurship stuff. You got junk to you, right? I was like, yeah. She said, can you run our committee for entrepreneurship economic development for Fuel Milwaukee? I'm like, okay, cool. And that put me back into like the business circle. So it's irony that that same night at the time, it was county executive Scott Walker was in the room. Later, so 2009, I'm back in the workforce. I'm doing sales support at a marketing firm. By 2012, I get appointed to be in Governor Walker's administration. So I went from being a janitor 08 to being appointed to state government in 2012. And that's just come from hustle. It comes from grind. Jason Fields gave me this best advice ever. Representative Jason Fields, he just said, even when you're at your lowest point, even when you hit rock bottom, just start moving side to side because your momentum will carry you back up.
Wow. Wow. I like that. And we love Jason Fields, by the way, too. So how long after, well, I don't want to skip over this government appointment, because what I think I remember is you started to develop a sense of passion, purpose, mission, combining not just opportunity to make money, entrepreneurship, but also social good. Can you talk to us about how your values started to develop? Because I know it's going to, you know, you've been carrying it into your current enterprise, but talk to us about how this government experience helped you to kind of shape that. And what I would say is come up with your own solution for, I'm going to say, capitalism and social good.
Yeah, definitely. So when I was working at 360 Direct, I was watching in the morning news one day, and they interviewed this gentleman named Dr. Muhammad Yunus, and he had just wrote a book, A World Without Poverty. And he was talking about this whole concept of social enterprise, so where you can blend, you know, the nonprofit sector with the for-profit sector, which I had never heard of in my life. And so when I read that book, I was just blown away. Like the stuff he was doing on microfinance, Indonesia, and stuff like that matter. I said, wow, why can't we do this in Milwaukee, where we have high levels of poverty, concentrated poverty in communities of color. Capitalism on its own is not working. The trickle-down isn't working. But I don't believe alternative models are simply the solution either. Like, we need to be more practical and pragmatic in how we approach this and our interventions. So I started connecting with a gentleman, Jeff Snell, at Marquette University, who at the time was like a special assistant to the president. And I was working with them. And then eventually when I went to, you know, I got the opportunity to go to the Department of Children and Families, which was the best decision of my life. Because at the time I felt like, I'm a business person. Why aren't you going to put me in like WEDA or Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation? Like, I'm not married. I don't have no kids. I don't want to be at the child welfare agency. It's crazy. But when I got there, I was just like, oh my God, because, you know, Secretary Eloise Anderson, who, again, another transformational person in my life, she brought me on and she explained to me and said, I brought you here because even though welfare is about families, it's primarily been targeting women for decades. And that has destroyed families, especially families in the Black community, because we feel like if the father is not present, that he must be no good. So either he'll have a child support order or send him to prison. And government, whether intentionally or unintentionally, have been destroying families and communities of color for decades. We need to repair that. And so she said, somebody like myself, she says, what I need, and she's very, very, like, very blunt woman. She just said, I'm looking for a young Black man from north side of Milwaukee who understands business and not scared of white Republicans. And there's, like, two of us in the entire state. And I was the one who was free. So she could afford me. She couldn't afford the other one. It's actually quite four of us, but she couldn't. I was affordable at the time. So I went to that job, and my whole thing was like, I need to work on reducing the barriers to employment for Black and brown men, look at the needs of large employers, and then make the connection. And then while I was there, she pretty much said, you know, you can do anything you want to do as long as, you know, you don't, like, cost me any money or embarrass me. I'm like, okay, I can do that. It's kind of like a mother-son relationship. So I said, I also want to work on social education, which is kind of like, to your point, how do young Black boys and girls get learn through osmosis from people in positions of leadership and, success and stuff of that nature. So how do we be intentional about creating those interactions? And then I also said, you know, government is addicted to job creation, but they never look at self-employment as a form of job creation. And I was like, I'm an entrepreneur. I don't want to work at, with all due respect, I don't want to be a manufacturer, because y'all keep telling me you can make so much money being a welder. You can make so much money driving a forklift. Like, then you go drive a forklift. I want to run the company. So, and of course, people look at me like, man, this dude off the chain. Like, you don't want to drive a forklift for $15.50 an hour? It's like, no, I want to run the company that owns the forklift. And so I said, I don't want to work with any company that – I'm like, the only way I want to work with partner any company in Milwaukee to access the talent in my community – is that if they didn't look at these people of color from these low-income environments as potential leaders of their company in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, then we can't be partners. Because you got to stop coming to my community and looking at us as a collection of consumers, voters, criminals.
Or low-income wage job holders.
Yeah, that's it. Just like, oh, we're just labor for you. Like, no, we are more than that. We're way more than that. So that was really what I did for 4 years, was trying to, like, change the narrative about the Department of Children and Families, about how we're going to actually transform the lives of people in the community and work on job creation, job development. And we took a more clinical approach, which, again, was the best thing ever, because I think all the other agencies, they use a more transaction approach. It's like, we take money, we invest in housing, we take money, we invest in business relocation. And we were simply saying, like, that's great, but if you don't change the mental, emotional, and behavioral health of these individuals, that new school ain't going to work. That new job.
No change is going to stay.
No. And so that's what I did for 4 years there.
Wow. So with having that level of impact, well, I guess this answers my question, but I'm going to still answer it. What spurred you or what had you move out? Because at this point, did you move out to where you are now with your current business?
Yeah, so the long and short, I think my partner Isaac McCoy is on here too. So we get into trouble together a lot. So I've lived in 5 cities in 5 years, and so I tell people I moved twice for the money and twice for a honey. And so so I moved from, at 2016, you know, it was like 3 elections, 1 recall. It's ridiculous in politics of Wisconsin. I was exhausted. And I was underpaid. And so I saw an opportunity to go out to Washington, D.C. So I worked at Stand Together Foundation, which people may or may not know. That's part of the broader Koch network, which is K-O-C-H. Everybody's like, oh, the evil Koch brothers. So I'm just like, the 600 millionaires and billionaires, they own everything. You can't avoid them. So you're working with them without realizing it. You're buying from them without realizing it. So it's best to have unlikely partners to do unlikely things. So I moved to D.C. to have unlikely partners to do unlikely things. So out in D.C., worked for Stand Together. It was mostly about venture philanthropy. How do we take this infinite sums of wealth, knowledge, and capital and reinvest in the communities across the country and basically kind of D.C. model for nonprofits, scale and growth solutions at the community level. And then I did that for like 2 years. And then, so that was a money move. Then I moved to Baltimore, and that was with my ex. And so she's the smarter one. She's a physician. And so she's like, I'm going to Johns Hopkins. Like, I guess I'm going to Johns Hopkins too. And so she's paying the bills. I mean, what I was supposed to do. And so went to Baltimore, went there for a year. And then after that, I was actually doing my own consulting firm at the time, working with Isaac again, doing consulting. Some of my clients that followed me from Stand Together to do some stuff, but things were really, you know, weren't clicking like I wanted it to. So she got a job in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Again, she said, we about to go to Fort Wayne. I'm like, I'm going to Fort Wayne too. And so moved to Fort Wayne for the honey. And then we were there till I guess earlier February 2020, I moved to Chicago. And the reason I moved to Chicago is because through the last 10 years, I've deferred a lot of earnings. I got a lot of knowledge and experiences, but I deferred a lot of earnings and a lot of personal wealth by spending so much time in the government, philanthropic sector. And one thing I recognized, whether I traveled to Dallas or Baltimore or D.C. or Denver or Chicago or San Diego or Milwaukee or anywhere in the country, every community had the same problem, and every community had problem solvers, but all these problem solvers are underfunded. And my role at that time, I was a good, you know, what I would say is like, Jamie, what do you do? And because like, you're not in business because I see your checks. You ain't making that much money. And you're not a nonprofit either because you don't sound like any nonprofit person I ever heard. So what do you do? And I said, I am a translator from the corporate suites to the city streets. So people hired me and paid me to translate. And so I was good at brokering relationships between nonprofit leaders and social enterprise leaders on the ground level. The people who are corporate and, you know, high network individuals, celebrity, stuff like that. But, you know, but it was always this vision disconnect and stuff in that matter. And after I was working for a private equity firm in Fort Wayne. So going to Fort Wayne, even though socially it wasn't like great, but it was a great experience working for professionally, because working at Coke, I couldn't understand how a $125 billion a year company operates. But going to Fort Wayne, I could understand how a $1 billion a year company could operate. And I could understand how they were making acquisitions of other companies. And so when they had massive layoffs last year due to COVID, I sat there and I said, if I could go anywhere in the world and do anything I wanted to do, where would I go and what would I do? And I said, I want to do acquisition entrepreneurship. So my friend Isaac gave me a book that's, you know, it's called Buy, Then Build by Walker Diebold. And I read that book and I said, oh, this, like, why was I doing startups? I should have been buying companies from the beginning. And I always assumed you needed money to make money, and it's just not true. And so the minute I kind of, you know, me and Isaac and John McKeel partner up and said, we're going to start our own impact private equity firm, and we're going to start acquiring small companies throughout the country, and we're going to start growing them. And that way I can have my own capital to deploy back in this community when I want to, how I want to, use my own standards, use my own vision, use my own goals for change over time. That's, we started I2J Group in a year ago, and we made our first acquisition last month. So now we own our first kitchen and bathroom modeling company down in Dallas, Texas. We're about to buy another one probably in Milwaukee, God willing. But bottom line, we're committed to making millions of dollars in purchases of acquisitions of companies over the next 5 years. And then hopefully we can take, you know, up to 2% of that profit and reinvest it into a lot of these things that we were having to seek foundations and government to fund before.
Man, I'm so glad you took us all the way around the world to that point, because I couldn't have asked you a better question to, you know, to have you synthesize it the way that you did. And that's really why I wanted you on as a guest, because, again, you were the first person I've ever met that had the mind of a venture capitalist, but had the heart of a social worker, you know. And on my investing story, I really wanted to bring that perspective, your expertise, your experience, because I think, especially for us as Blacks, I mean, when you hit a certain level of wealth, I'm sure you probably get there. But, you know, many of us, we want to do good. And you know, that statement is for everybody. But a lot of times we will, similar to what you did on your path, we will forego making money in order to do good because we don't know another way. And then when we are making money, we are spending that money or giving that money so that it could do good. And I know that for many of us as long-term investors, yes, we want to grow our money to live comfortably. Yes, we want to grow it to live a legacy and leave a legacy and give an inheritance. But there, you know, I mean, we probably the most ethnic group that stay in church. You know, I don't know any more Black women that once they retire from work, they go working for the church, you know, as lifelong volunteers until the day they die, you know. And, but it's because that's ultimately what they want to do and where they want to give their gifts. And so, again, I'm so glad that you know, you were able to synthesize it and explain to us why you're doing the work that you're doing and the purpose that it has. Because, again, I haven't met anybody that have put the two so succinctly and really united their purpose with the method, you know, company acquisition. So my next question is actually about the mindset of being a business owner. And like we talked a little bit about before the show, the reason I want to bring this out is because for many of us who just recently started investing or playing in the stock market, many people are trading. Number one, they don't recognize the difference between trading and investing. And if you have a question about that, Google trading versus investing. I'll leave you to look at the memes that could, you know, explain the difference. But I think you're in a unique position to speak to how you evaluate companies as an owner, because as a Better Investing member and volunteer and board director, you know, that's how we evaluate companies. You know, when we do our stock selection guide, when we do our company analysis, we're looking at that company from an owner's perspective. What's the return on equity? You know, what's his financial statement saying over the past 5 to 10 years? What's the return on invested capital? What's the return on assets? That's the level of detail that we do research on before we make an investment, which is very different from a lot of people who right now are just looking at the stock price, looking at what's popular. Somebody sent me an Instagram post today about following Nancy Pelosi and what whoever else in Congress buying what. I looked at it and just moved on because I'm like, that's not how I invest. So yeah, talk to us about, you know, what are those things you look at as an owner? Because, again, your perspective is very different from many of the other investors we've had on the show.
Yeah, and so I think we talked about it even before the show started. Like, I have diversified revenue streams, right? So I still have a Charles Schwab account that has my IRA. I also have, you know, my portfolio, which I do trades, right? I don't actively trade like I used to. And so I buy, like, index funds. And so I got my Spider and stuff like that and watch it go up, go down, the boring stuff. I'm never going to get my Ferrari. But, but my kids can have it one day, I guess. But the thing is, the reason I wanted to be an owner, entrepreneur, is because, like, today, like, before we got on reading the Wall Street Journal, we were talking about, you know, Disney stock got battered. Why? Because they didn't get enough subscribers to, like, Disney Plus. The thing is, if I'm not, Disney's a large part of my portfolio because it's dividends, right? And I had dividend reinvestment on. So I had dividend reinvestment on since 2001. So it's been buying itself for a long time. I have no control over how Disney is able to add more subscribers. I just get to read the story and either say buy, sell. But I have no control over what they do to get more subscribers. When I buy a company, I have full control over how we acquire more customers and stuff of that nature. And so, for example, right, it's like, so me and Isaac have been dealing with this for the last 2 weeks, is that it's probably something nebulous, but like supply chain is very, very important at my company because not only do we install floors, countertops, cabinets, showers, yes, that was a soft plug, we saw that, please call us, but we also sell the material, right? And so, If we have to buy the material at a higher cost, we have to sell it to you at a higher cost. And then everybody on here is cost conscious. You're going to try to find who sells us the cheapest. And so our whole goal now is like we need to be able to find all of our materials at a lower cost. So I'm on literally online talking to a woman in China saying, like, how much can you sell, you know, laminate padding to me for? Like, I need to get it for like 7 cents a square foot. These are things I was not doing a year ago, but now I'm like addicted to it. It's like a video game. It's like I'm going to call everybody in the world, literally the world. My next call is in Vietnam tomorrow or next week to find out how I could drive that cost down from 14 cents a square foot, which we're paying in some places, down to like 5 cents a square foot. That way I have to raise costs on my customers. So that gives me full control as an owner. Same thing on pricing or marketing, right? So that's another thing. We're about to do a full rebrand of the company. Me and Isaac, that's literally a two-day conversation. Hey, Isaac, what do you think a good name would be? He came up with a name. So we're going to name the company that. It wasn't a process. It wasn't this. It wasn't that. It's just simply like, here's our logo. Okay, let's go get the logo printed, designed, put up. It just takes 2 weeks. If you do stock market investing, they may or may not follow your recommendations as a simple shareholder, right? No, I love Android phones. I have an LG phone. They're about to get out of the phone business because it's only 8% of their business was phone making. But I'm like, you make incredible phones. Why didn't you just pay Beyonce to, like, you know, market the phone for you? But I can't make that call for LG because I don't work there. I don't have no leadership, have no control. I'm just a consumer and a shareholder. At my company, nope, I get to call the shot.
Excellent. Talk to us about some of the metrics you look at when buying a business, or even walk us a little bit through, I mean, without any intellectual property, of course, but walk us a little bit through that process of what you looked at when you bought that first or made that first acquisition of a company.
Yeah, and I looking back, again, my father didn't understand business, and neither one of my parents understood business the way I do, but, like, if I had to go back to, like, ABCs, 1, 2, 3s with my kids, I also teach them how to read income statements, balance sheets, cash flow statements. I don't care if you're an employee or a shareholder, a manager. I feel like every person should be entitled to review the company finances. But that's your report card. If I know how the financials work, then I know how I could get a raise. And that will incentivize me to, like, you know, increase sales. Or, like, I might be like, I'm just a receptionist. But if I know I could get a raise, if we get a better quarterly earning, then I might be a receptionist who's handing out, you know, coupons on my way to the party. Or during my lunch hour, I'm, like, wearing the company jacket saying, go to our website. So one of the things I do, we do is, number one, yeah, we identify a company. We're always looking at, you know, when you're buying businesses in general, you're buying basically a multiple of the earnings. And so going back to my father said, right, he wasn't a business person, but he always said, it's not about how much money you make, it's how much you keep. That translates exactly to how I buy businesses. I could care less how much money, what's the top line revenue of a company. I only care how much money does that owner put in his pocket every single year, or could put in his pocket every single year. Like when he files his taxes, what did he tell the U.S. government that he made an income? That's what we're buying. The top line could care less. And so it's sexy to say I have a $1 million company, but if it's taking you $900,000 to get to that $1 million, then it's worthless compared to my $500,000 company that only takes $100,000 for me to get that. And so if we know we can make like a month, so we look for earnings above $200,000. That multiple might translate to 2.5. But that essentially means we're spending, it's going to cost us $500,000 to buy the company. And I can break that down. I know it's like some people are like, what is that?
Let's break it down because, I want to spend a little time from your perspective of company, because we look, again, like I mentioned, we look at PE ratio. We're also buying companies or shares of a company only at a certain time their earnings per share, I should say.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So when you're saying you're paying a certain multiple, maybe 2x the earnings, are you talking about net income? Are you talking about shareholder equity?
Exactly. Yeah. So this is the exact same concept. So in our space, it's called, because it's a company less than $5 million. So it's called the seller discretionary earnings. So when the seller sells it, they work with their broker, they kind of come up with discretionary earnings. So that's basically like an average of the last 3 years net income plus how much money that if he wasn't like, and then minus one-off expenses, right? So if he spent, you know, $20,000 on his lawyer this year for whatever reason, like you deduct that because that expense wouldn't translate to us. So what we pretty much do then is just say, hey, once we know your seller discretionary earning price, for the companies we look at, it typically averages around $200,000. So $200,000 means that once we make all our sales, we pay our staff, we pay our taxes, we pay our water bill, we pay our lease, we pay everything, we're going to put $200,000 back into our pocket. The only thing we need to deduct from that is, like, because we are using, like, bank loans and investors to buy it, we do have to pay them, so we have to deduct from that $200,000. But other than that, that's, once we pay everybody off, that's how much money goes back into our pocket every single year. So because, you know, the person bought the company and it's a healthy company, the company should be appreciating the value every single year. Depending on the size of the company, they typically might say, okay, I'm going to sell it at 2.5x what the discretionary earnings are. So basically 200,000 times 2.5. That's how you get the $500,000. So that's the starting point for the. That's how they might price it. They might say, you can buy my company making whatever in top line revenue for $500,000. And then for us, we'll come in there and say, okay, we're going to knock off, we're going to try to, you know, that's his asking price or her asking price. We naturally want to pay less than that. So that's how we start negotiating. I'm like, okay, how about we give you $480, you know, and we won't ask for, and we're going to try to do like a 60-day close. Because we might have to pay the same price if we ask for like seller financing. That's where you get complicated on how you fund it. So like the seller could become the bank and they can offer seller financing where you start paying them a certain amount of money over a period of years.
It sounds similar to some mortgage and home buying processes.
And the irony is, right, so like real estate acquisition is really prevalent in the black community. Like, I got me a job. I'm going to go buy a duplex. The same, there's a lot of the process going into buying that duplex, that four family. It's the same thing in a business. The business just sounds bigger, though, right? It doesn't sound like you can make a $20,000 down payment and buy a business the same way you can buy a duplex. But the reality, what we found is you can't. I don't put my own money into these acquisitions. And so we can buy businesses. Yeah, the business in Milwaukee, we get it. It's going to cost about $25,000. So we only bring it in one investment. So, like, how do you buy a business, a million-dollar business for $25,000? Like, you can do it.
I'm so glad you brought this to our awareness because, you know, you don't know. And I'm only learning about this real estate thing. So when I heard you talking about your process, I'm like, wait, that sounds familiar, which is awesome to have you here as a guest because this is the type of stuff I know I want to be exposed to and I'm sure other people want to be exposed to. And a lot of times we only can do what we're exposed to. So thank you for breaking that down. The book Build, Buy, Then Build by Walker
Diebel,
D-E-I-B-E-L. What other things or resources or books can somebody read to get more on this information and, this, and learn this process you're talking about?
Yeah, Stanford has something called the search fund model. They developed it. That's something I've looked at first. It's free, honestly. If you go to, like, if you Google Stanford University search fund, I think it's got the search fund guide. It's like 90 pages. It kind of walks you through the whole process, except they use a different model to where they were, even Harvard does this now, too. Like, they teach graduate-level students how to, like, create a fund where people literally pay them, give them money to, like, search for businesses to buy. Then once they find it, they'll convert that search money into, like, capital to, like, do the initial acquisition of the company. So you have, like, 24-year-olds buying $10 million companies. But, of course, they only – the reason we would go with that model, this is more like Isaac, right? I was just like, yeah, we should buy a $20 million company. He was like, we don't have majority ownership. I don't want to do it. In the search fund model, you only get up to 30%. And so he was like, we don't get at least 51, we ain't doing it. So we ended up doing it. We're going to do it this way, which I love that we did it this way because our investors don't call us every night saying, where's my money at? It's just like, well, we're the majority owners, and you kind of committed to the long term, the five-year strategy. So we just meet quarterly with them. Stanford Search Fund Guide. Harvard has one, but honestly it's not as good as the rest. But I'll say start with those two. And something we've been talking about is that
which –
Buy the bill.
Okay. Keep going.
And there's just not a lot of literature out there on this, which is weird because acquisition entrepreneurship is something that is either considered private equity or it's nebulous, right? It's not like duplexes. This is making me unpopular in my circles because I came out of the startup world, but I'm like, startup world, it's like smoke and mirrors. You know, I keep investing so much money. Because I'm not sharing anything.
Because they're not proven businesses yet. I mean, you're buying existing businesses, existing clients.
And so our whole model is that, right now, and I'll tell you our whole secret sauce, because we can never execute to the level we need to. And I learned this in Fort Wayne, is that, especially in places like the Midwest, Florida, where you guys might be around, is that we're going to have the largest transfer of wealth in probably history happening over the next 20 years, where baby boomers are just running out of time. If they have great, sound businesses, a lot of them don't have kids or family members or employees want to take them over. That company has to go somewhere. And for a lot of them, they're saying, like, me selling this company is my retirement. Like, I didn't have a big 401k come out of corporate or whatever. I get to go hang out at the beach and travel the world and get my yacht by selling this company. And so you're surprised, but people are just like, man, you know, old white people are racist. You're surprised by how non-racist a person seeking to sell their company really is. So we've gone into manufacturing plants where a person would literally had a calendar talking about a MAGA calendar. But it's like three black guys in there, two black guys in there, like a super liberal white guy. He's just like, what deal can we do? He didn't care about our race, didn't care about our age. He just said, he was explicit. I'm trying to get to Florida and get on the beach. Get me a drink and check out some ladies. That's all he cared about. This is like a 65-year-old white guy. And so our whole model is basically saying, how can we preserve the legacy of baby boomer sellers and also help continue to establish and create impact in the communities they were serving? because of a private equity firm coming there, a lot of them are simply trying to come in there and just, you know, strip the assets of the company. They're going to fire the staff, yada, yada, yada. Of course, if you sell to like a foreign investor, they really don't care about that manufacturing plant that's been creating jobs in that community for 60 years. We're very committed to community, right? We're impacting private equity firms. So we're not here to lay off people. We're not here to like take the company, remove the company from its rural or urban place. We're here to grow the jobs in place, grow the company in place. And so we get in a lot of doors by simply with that message. And we encourage other people as well to say, hey, like, you know, take that same message and find these numerous companies that are for sale today in a neighborhood near you where the person is simply saying, I live in Wisconsin, winter's coming, I need to get to Florida. Let's do a deal in 90 days.
Yeah, Jeremy, I gotta catch up with you. I think you I think I bit the bug. I think that may be the next thing. I'm going to make a plug before I hand it over to Ms. McNeil. I'm going to say that if you have not joined Better Investing yet and you're under 25, please join ASAP. For anybody, and I'm thinking about when I was growing up, I did not know what I wanted to do. I did not know. But I was a member of Better Investing. I learned how to invest. And what I'm now realizing 20 years later is that by being a Better Investing member, by learning how to invest, which essentially is learning how to evaluate companies, it actually has given me a skill set that my alma mater didn't give me and other job experience didn't give me. And this was on my own time. And so now I'm able to possibly take advantage of an opportunity with Jamie or other opportunities because, like Jamie said, I know how to read an income statement. I know how to read a balance sheet and not just read it from a consumer perspective or an employee perspective or an accountant perspective, but from an owner's perspective. And that's the type of experience and education you're going to get with Better Investing. And so with that plug, I'm going to hand it off to Ms. Ann. I didn't leave you with much time, Ms. Ann, but you take as much time as you need.
You have jokes.
Always have jokes.
Listen, you have jokes, and Jamie, you have been simply phenomenal. I actually have 4 pages of notes, so I'm literally blown away. This is, for those of you that have just come on to share this phenomenal guest with us, you're listening to hashtag My Investing Story. And this has been the story of Jamie the Elder. And what you may have heard was really his heart. His heart for entrepreneurship, but also a spirit of service. And a phenomenal background, you know, at age 28, he was appointed to Governor Scott Walker's administration to serve. He has been all over the place. But as a serial, almost a serial entrepreneur with a heart for service, I just really want to thank you for blessing us with your story. And like I said, I have literally 4 pages of notes going all the way back to the book that you mentioned. And what I love about, and I'm going to read this, you know, how do you convert the legacy of the baby billionaires, that's Ione, baby boomers, and be committed to the community and finding companies in the neighborhoods near you. I mean, we can all relate to that. What you shared with us about the Koch brothers, I think was very enlightening. You know, I have four pages of notes. I'm not going to go through all of them. But on behalf of all of our listeners and everyone participating, a lot of people that are normally here with us every single week, I'd like to challenge each of you to put something in the chat and let Mr. Elder know some thoughts that you may have. And Ione, if we could take the executive privilege, I don't know if there's a question. Maybe one of our guests in the audience may have, either on, you know, we are live on Facebook, And so we do want to remind everybody that this is truly a story about becoming a better investor. And Ione already shared, we are volunteers with Better Investing. So I have to do that plug because we are not day traders. We're not selling stocks. We're not recommending anything. Better Investing is a not-for-profit 501c3 not-for-profit organization. Been around for, I want to say forever, but actually since 1951.
70 years.
Since 1951, yes, 70 years. And with that thought in mind, if you are interested in becoming a better investor and you'd like to participate in our 90-day free trial, you can go to betterinvesting.org, and on the front page, right at the very bottom, you can volunteer to be a better investor for 90 days for free. Betterinvesting.org. But if we can just check the chat and see if there are any questions. Okay, great. I think you've said it all. Jamie, you said it all. Thank you so very much. And Ione, you, as always, have been phenomenal. Want to thank you for another phenomenal interview. We're going to ask everybody to remember that the Better Investing Conference has been referred over to NextShare 2022. And so we'll look to see you then. But until then, we'll see you next Wednesday, same time, same place. All right.
Oh, before we let everybody go, Jamie, do you want to, I don't know if you have social media handles or contact, if you want to share with people that may want to connect with you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm whack on social media, honestly, so go share that. But you can probably follow me on LinkedIn. I mean, definitely, LinkedIn's probably the best place. Just type in Jamie Elder. You'll see me pop up. Like, my handle's like J-M-E-E-L-D-E-R. You could definitely feel free to, I mean, blast on my email address. That's probably the best way to reach me. Anybody wants to communicate, JBE at I2J Group. That's the number two. JBE@i2jgroup.com. So that's the best way to hit me up. And I think, you know, on that note, and a lot of time we do a lot of these speaking engagements. And I know people right now, they have questions, stuff like that. But like, I would say the worst thing you could do for yourself is not following up. The reason why I've been doing this for 21 years, I've seen a lot of brothers and sisters come and go. The ones that stayed are those who stayed in the game. So the people want to play it cool, but like, I ain't going to ask nothing. I'm not going to follow up because I know everything. I'm not going to get far. So that when I'm telling you, my door is wide open. Please take advantage of it.
Yeah, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm going to follow up because
we do have a question. If you could put that email in the chat, because I think you said a little quick. And there is a request if you could put it in the chat.
So Jamie will put it in the chat before we get off.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, the reason we asked for it is so that people who are interested in learning could reach out to you because, again, you may be the only person that they've come across that is in this line of business. And yeah, it's just such a wonderful experience because many people growing up may not know what they want to do, but I think that this type of information and experience is invaluable. So thank you.
All right, Pat, you did see your question in the chat, so he's going to put his email in the chat. Patricia Edwards, thank you again for joining, and I think that he can chat with you about that seminar. All right,
yep.
Everybody, Angelina, everybody, thank you so very much. Yes. All right, everybody, see you next week. Let's just make sure, because we want to give people a chance to check the chat.
No, it's fine. They could email me if they have a question.
Okay. All right, perfect. All right. All right, everybody, see everybody next week.
Thanks, Jamie.
All right, thank you, Jamie.